Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
We've all dreamed of an antiques roadshow moment, like the day last year when Charles Dodge brought in an 1896 portrait of his great-grandfather.
And this piece, together with the letter, would be something that I would value at auction between $600,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And $800,000.
I was hoping I would be wildly exuberant. I am.
That letter you heard referred to helped prove the painting was by Frederick Remington. In order to own it, Dodge's grandmother reportedly was asked to buy two other Remington paintings from a dealer and trade them with the Remington Museum for this one. Dodge's grandmother appears to have had good intentions, but decades later, the museum concluded the paintings it took in trade for the masterpiece were forgeries, mediocre ones at that. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This story might sound like a once-in-a-lifetime swindle, but some experts have estimated as many as 40 or even 50% of the paintings and statues and sculptures on the market have been misattributed or outright forged. Anthony M. Amore is here to tell us how it happens and what can be done about it. He's head of security and chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum of Art in Boston. His new book is called The Art of the Con, The Most Notorious Fakes, Frauds, and Forgeries in the Art World. Anthony, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris.
I know that I will never have the skills to judge whether a work of art is genuine, but I have always assumed that any art historian, curator could spot a fake from across the room. Why is it so hard for even experts to know what's real?
Well, you know, it's not as easy as one would think to spot a fake across the room. I think that there's a lot of elements at play. You have very talented people out there who can make believable copies of art. And I'm not even talking about the most skilled artist walking amongst us. I'm talking about maybe a good student at an art school, an art college, that sort of thing, can make convincing copies, especially when you're talking about paintings that are maybe impressionist paintings or abstract expressionist paintings. The other element that comes into play is that when there's a new piece on the market, there is a strong desire amongst some to believe that they found what no one else has found before. So that desire, that want to believe, is a key element in being fooled by a con man.
And it turns out that forged paintings are much easier to trade in than stolen works because people are on the lookout for things that have been famously stolen.
For the most part, when you're talking about, well, you said it well, famously stolen. When you're talking about high-value, highly recognizable masterworks that are stolen, they become too hot to handle, and they're very, very rarely sold because exactly as you said, people are aware of them. But when you're talking about a skilled forger who creates a piece that's a believably, say, a Pollock, whose works are also often victimized, when that person's able to combine their work with a creative backstory, then you have a real good chance to be conned.
I don't want to condone any of this because it's all dishonest and it's just wrong. But you have to give points. Sometimes the backstory and the forged documents theoretically proving the provenance of these things, they're as creative as the paintings themselves.
You're right on the money. In the book, I speak about this famous forger, Wolfgang Beltracchi, who really captured a lot of people's imagination. And Beltracchi and his wife put probably more effort into the backstory than they did in the art. Now, what Beltracchi would do is imagine artists such as Kemp and Donk or Max Ernst were still alive, and he painted what he thought they might paint. But like you said, when he created these backstories, he really went above and beyond, and that was a key in him being able to sell millions of dollars worth of these forgeries.
So tell us exactly how he did it. He and his wife were essentially partners in crime, and they created whole characters. They created a whole world of people that would have collected this art.
They did. What they seized upon the whole idea of degenerate art that the Nazis had basically outlawed and tried to destroy during the Third Reich. And Beltracchi's wife, Helene, had a grandfather named Werner Jaegers, and she created the story that her grandfather had accumulated a large amount of art from a gallery in Germany, and held it and hid it during the Second World War and left it to her. And now she was reintroducing it to the market. One of the ways that they proved, quote unquote, to people that the art was authentic is they produced photos of Helene's grandmother, old photos of her sitting in her home with these paintings on the wall behind her. Well, in truth, what they did was Wolfgang Beltracchi went out and found a period camera, film, and paper, and took pictures of his wife dressed as her own grandmother in front of this art and produced these bogus photos, and people bought it.
Yeah, it's funny that she must have struck people as looking exactly like her grandmother, but in some ways that contributes to the coolness of the story for people who thought they had found the bargain of a lifetime.
It does, and if you see the photo, I have a photo in my book. Yeah. I was really happy to get a copy of their bogus photo. You can see where people would look and say, well, you know, there's a family resemblance, but it didn't look exactly like Helene. Helene is much younger, and she has this very long, you can't miss, this very long light brown hair. And in the photo, the hair is tied back tight in a bun, and it appears to be gray. And the grandmother, when she appears as a grandmother, she seems very stern. And it's ingenious.
What kind of evidence is considered incontrovertible for verifying that an artist who is of note has actually created a work that is up for sale?
You know, it's difficult to have incontrovertible work. Provenance, one of the issues is that provenance is a difficult subject matter. Because there is no standard, there is no one thing that people can point to and say, well, this is perfect provenance. There's very good provenance, or there's suspect provenance, essentially. And, I mean, if you have a photo of the artist painting a piece, and that piece is in the possession of his widow, for example, I mean, that would be very strong provenance. But even still, it could be a copy. So it's difficult to have incontrovertible evidence. You can have evidence that tells you that it is definitively not by an artist, though, and that's where these technicians, these scientists, come into play.
I was wondering if DNA will someday be attached to major works of art to establish provenance for them.
Well, in some respects, it's used often. I shouldn't say often. In some cases where, for instance, they might find a hair on the canvas. That's a rare case. Or maybe they've been attempts to pull thumbprints or fingerprints off of different canvases. But, you know, in essence, when I talk a lot about stolen and faked art and how it's identified, and in essence, when scientists look at the chemical composition of the pigments used in the paintings, that can serve as sort of a DNA in itself.
There are a number of ways that fraud can happen. First is simply making up an excellent copy of an existing work. There was this very famous portrait of George Washington that in the 18th century suddenly seems to have multiplied. Tell us what happened there.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories because I'm really interested in colonial America. And as a Rhode Islander, I've always liked Gilbert Stuart's work. And when I was researching this book, I found that when Stuart created the Athenaeum portrait of George Washington, which is the seminal depiction of our founding father, the one that appears even on the dollar bill. When he created that, there was a great demand in the United States for that image. And Stuart would sell copies of it that he made himself. One day, he was approached by a ship's captain. Captain Swords was his name. And he told Stuart he wanted to buy one of these copies of George Washington, and Stuart obliged, but he was very, very adamant that the condition had to be that the captain would not have copies made. And of course, the captain assured him, no, this was just for his private use. So he bought the painting from Stuart, whose whole life was riddled with financial problems. Swords got the painting of George Washington, immediately went to his ship, sailed for China, and had 100 copies of the painting made and brought them back for sale. So it's really the first, I would say, at least big money sort of art forgery case in American history.
How did people begin to discover that there were many, many copies that had not been done by the original artist?
Of Washington?
Yes.
Well, you know, I stumbled upon this story. I was at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, and saw one of these Chinese paintings, copies of George Washington. And I was struck by it because I spend a lot of time looking at these Stuart portraits. And I said, you know, that isn't quite right. There's something about that. And you can see it's not right on, but it's a good enough likeness. And then I started to research it. So if you know the Athenaeum painting, you can see that this is a copy and it's not a copy by Stuart. So when you research it backwards, you start to find the history of the painting.
Something that struck me time and again, Anthony, reading this book, was that the fact that in many cases, the people doing the forgery are actually incredibly talented. Why could they not sell their own paintings under their own names in the same style that they are passing it off as someone else's work?
You know, that's the major question. I think it's greed. I mean, when you look at some of these forgers, they are very fine copyists. But again, these sorts of copyists aren't as rare as one would think. Oftentimes, these forgers have tried on their own to be successful artists. There's the case that took down the Nerdla Gallery in New York City, where these nefarious art dealers, Glafira Rosales and her live-in boyfriend, were seeking out a copyist. And they know that the Chinese especially are famous for training by copying. So Rosales's boyfriend hunted the streets of Manhattan, and he found a Chinese street artist whose work he took a liking to and paid him a small sum to create copies of works by Pollock or Mark Rothko and other Abex painters. So he was a talented artist, but he wasn't anyone where you would say, my God, he is one of our greats. He was struggling to survive as a street artist, but when you combine the element of a compelling backstory and a passable fraud, you do find a market because there's so much money at stake. People are surprisingly willing to suspend disbelief.
This morning before the show, I was on Etsy, you know, the handcrafts website, and there are indeed tons of people who will sell you. They're not claiming to, you know, have discovered things by the original artist, but they will sell pretty good facsimiles of famous works. Is there anything illegal about that if you're not passing them off as originals?
Well, you know, when you use an image, let's suppose you're using an image of a painting by Pollock that hangs at the Met. In order to use that image, you're supposed to gain permission and oftentimes pay a fee to the museum because they have the rights to that image. So when people take these paintings and they put them on a canvas of their own, or they sell them as giclées online, which is very common, or you know they even put them on T-shirts and coffee mugs, there is an issue about rights for that image.
I didn't know where the word giclée came from until I read your book, and I had thought it would be something a little more romantic than what it is.
Well, they clearly worked hard to come up with a name that sounded romantic.
Right.
Giclée, almost, it's sort of a made-up name, and it's sort of made-up art.
And it means something like inkjet?
Essentially, yep. And it's because the genesis of a giclée image that you might buy online, or you could buy at a gallery, is essentially just a very, very good printer. A lot of museums have them themselves. They can create copies of pieces on paper to put on display as duplicates to take important paintings out of the light for a while to give them some rest, basically. So, you know, this giclée has taken over with the advent of these great printers.
Anthony M. Amore is my guest. He is head of security and chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum of Art in Boston and author of the new book, The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the head of security and chief investigator from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, Anthony M. Amore. He has a new book out called The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Anthony, what role has eBay played in the market for forged paintings?
eBay presents a real challenge. I do know that the company does try to prevent the introduction of forged or faked pieces onto their website, but it is extremely difficult. Any one of your listeners who goes onto eBay and does a search for any artist, they're going to find works. For instance, if you go onto eBay and search for a Rembrandt, you might find a painting attributed to him. You might find some paintings that are school of Rembrandt. You're certainly going to find etchings attributed to Rembrandt. And if you're familiar with eBay, you know you have to read the real fine print on each page to see the provenance of each. On top of that, there are people, unscrupulous people, who make copies and sell them on eBay as originals.
Is it true that if you can paint like Rembrandt, but you were born in 1980, you will never become a famous painter?
I don't believe so. I've been fortunate in my time to spend a lot of time around Rembrandt paintings, and in fact, I've been searching for a Rembrandt, two Rembrandts, and an etching for 10 years now. So I spend a lot of time looking at Rembrandts, and I'm convinced that if you can paint like Rembrandt, you're going to be famous because his work is just so spectacular. But I think that's probably true of a lot of other artists, that if you are on the same talent level as some artists who are household names now, you might never become famous. It's not just the technical skill, it's the inspiration in what era you're creating.
When you say you've been searching for two Rembrandts and an etching, I'm guessing these are not for your personal collection. These are to replace the ones stolen from the Gardner Museum.
Right. It's not to replace. It's to find the ones that were
stolen.
Excuse
me. Yes, right.
No, that's perfectly fine. We, at the Gardner in 1990, 13 of our pieces were stolen. It's the biggest property theft, never mind art heist, in the history of the world. And my job is to try to find these things, and it's been about a decade now that I've been looking. So I am well acquainted with the works of Rembrandt and Vermeer, et cetera.
How often do you have leads that actually sound promising to you?
It's frequent. I work really close with the FBI in a lot of these leads, and we've had instances where we thought we were right there. We've recovered dozens of other stolen pieces of art. You follow these leads to their natural end, and sometimes you find pieces, sometimes it's a person with good intentions who just had the wrong story. Sometimes you're dealing with con men, but we've yet to get to the point where we've been able to put our hands on any of our 13 pieces.
I would have assumed that anyone who chooses to buy something from an established art dealer would be safe because those dealers' reputations are so important to their business. But there have been some who have, I guess, gotten greedy, tricked not only the buyers, but the artists who are producing these forged works.
That's true. You know, if we were talking about this 10 years ago and you said name two of the biggest galleries in Manhattan, one I would say is the Nerdler Gallery and the other I'd say probably is Salinger O'Reilly Gallery in Manhattan, and both of those are out of business today essentially because of major frauds that were perpetrated through their galleries, where in the first case with the Nerdler Gallery, the director suspended disbelief and took the word of a dealer, the person I mentioned earlier, Ms. Rosales, and sold art that turned out to be by a Chinese street artist who created it in his garage in Queens, literally left it in his driveway to dry, sold it for tens of millions of dollars. In the latter case with Salinger, Mr. Salinger was prosecuted and convicted and is in prison now for taking pieces of art that he was holding for artists or artist families and selling. It was basically a Ponzi scheme. He was selling ownership of these paintings to different investors. He'd sell 50% to one guy, 50% to another, another 50% to a third guy, and have all these different people having well in excess of 100% ownership share in paintings. And that wound up bringing his gallery down as well. So both of those are closed today because of these different frauds.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Carlos in Greenville. Hi, Carlos.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
Okay, I have a question. I'm a professional artist. My own pieces go anywhere between, I'd say, about 1,000 and 10,000 when I'm lucky. So I have clients lately, they've been asking me to do remakes of other great artists of my time, my past time. They want me to do mock-ups or maybe copy exactly. My question is if I die, obviously my value may increase a little bit. Who knows? But if I do die, does the original piece that I made of another artist, so say I redo like a Van Gogh piece, right? Does that piece increase because my value has increased? Or is it just another copy in the market? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Interesting question, Carlos.
Thanks, Carlos. Well, you know, every case is unique. It's hard to say. There are forgers who, once they've been exposed, their works that they make afterwards, or even the forgeries they made, have actually, in some cases, become valuable because their story is so intriguing or romantic or famous. It's difficult to say what will drive the value of any piece of art. Typically, copies aren't going to be extremely valuable, but there are cases where really good copies of art by upstanding and ethical artists who don't try to portray them as originals can go for a decent amount of money. But Carlos, unfortunately, I can't assure you that your death will increase your fame.
What happens, Anthony? Let's hope Carlos lives a long and healthy life instead. What happens, Anthony, in cases where it really does happen that somebody's cleaning out grandma's attic and finds a painting behind a chest and it might be worth something, but it comes with no documentation? Where ideally does a work like that go to be appraised and evaluated, and how do the people doing this work try to figure out exactly what they're looking at?
Well, typically what you see is that people will bring pieces like that to sometimes they'll try through a museum, but that's really not the business of a museum unless it's a really important find. Oftentimes they'll bring paintings or sculptures or what have you to a local reputable auctionaire or art gallery. And it's very difficult to get someone to go on the record and say, yes, this is by such and such. And other times they might contact the person who has created the catalog of that artist's life's work. So there's a variety of different places to go. And each painting carries with it its own history that makes proving its authenticity unique to that painting. I mean, you can go to different types of scientists. The one I talk about the most in my book, these two incredible scientists that have a company called Art Analysis and Research based out of Britain. And what makes them unique is they're not just scientists. They have these technologies that, Chris, I could never memorize the names of these things. they're unbelievable. But they combine their ability with this technical work with their education as art researchers and conservators. So they can combine those two separate schools of education into authenticating a painting. So I know it's a long answer, but it's difficult to say what one thing will put you over the top for a specific work.
Let's say that I'm brilliant and criminally minded, and I want to create a painting and pass it off as some, you know, centuries-old masterwork. How do you make something that was done in the 21st century look hundreds of years old?
Well, that's always a difficult question because I worry about giving some ideas to forgers. But essentially what you would want to do is you'd have to make sure, if you were smart about it, that the pigments, the materials that you're using are contemporaneous with the artist of his time. Now, if you're talking about a Rembrandt or a Vermeer, you have to really understand the chemical composition to the ground that they used, the sorts of canvas, the weaving of the canvas, what roll of canvas it was cut from. Those things go into the research. And then you'd have to know exactly which pigments they mixed, how they mixed them, the percentage of pigments to make up certain colors, what was available at their time. then you'd have to be able to duplicate their brushstrokes. That's why, in my estimation, that forgers stay away from the great masters. It's I don't want to say it's easier because I don't want to give the listener the impression I'm putting down the work, but you can see when I explain that to you why a forger is much more likely to try to recreate a Jackson Pollock than they are to try to recreate a Vermeer.
And perhaps the most brazen example of this is there are forgers who have taken the work of living artists and tried to duplicate it and pass it off.
Oh, yeah. And there's, you know, one of the famous examples I talk about in the book is it's really sad, I think, the way Jasper Johns was victimized just in the last decade. His famous work, The Flag, was he used it, a trusted mold maker to create the molds for his work, which is a three-dimensional work. And that mold maker kept the original molds and then created more. And then later, one of Jasper Johns' trusted assistants took 22 works that belonged to Jasper Johns and said they were gifted to him. And again, during Johns' lifetime, was outselling these. And to see a great living artist, I mean, he won the Medal of Freedom. He's one of the great American artists, and to see him victimized, especially in his older age, is a difficult thing to watch. So, it happens that living artists are victimized often.
You write about Jasper Johns testifying in court against this mold maker, and I guess he was asked in cross-examination, well, isn't it true that you gave permission for this guy to make as many copies as he wanted? And I guess he just burst into laughter and said, no, that is not true.
Right, and that's exactly right. And Johns is famously, I don't want to say abrupt, but he doesn't mince words. And he went right to his quick no. And you know, the idea that Jasper Johns would just give a mold of one probably his seminal work is really preposterous.
So, Anthony, some of the people that we have talked about, some of the forgers, have been inarguably talented. They've been good at creating copies that fooled a lot of people. Sometimes copies or forgeries that are not very good at all end up getting bought and sold for very large sums of money. How does this happen?
You know, it's something I referred to earlier in our conversation where, again, you have the market demanding new works. These things sell for exorbitant sums, especially more contemporary works you see on the market in the $100 million range. And, you know, actually Renaissance paintings are on the upswing again, too. So you have people out there who have a real strong demand for paintings that, you know, there is a finite supply. But the art world is murky, and people don't really know. You really never know all of an artist's body of work. It is true that new ones emerge from time to time. So when somebody comes forward with something that's plausible, but more importantly, they have a strong backstory attached to it, it doesn't surprise me, at least it doesn't surprise me anymore, that they're able to find people who will suspend disbelief. In the Nerdler Gallery case I mentioned a few times, Ann Friedman was a director there and a very reputable person, decades of experience in Abex art. And she was approached with these believable pieces, you know, that didn't stand up to science at all, but she was approached with believable pieces of art. And the backstory involved a quote-unquote Mr. X from Switzerland, literally Mr. X. And I think if you or I were buying a used car, and someone said, well, it belonged to Mr. X, I think you'd clutch and probably step back.
But, red flag. Right.
Red flag, thank you. But the Nerdler Gallery went forward and bought these and then sold them on to two important clients.
Other red flags, you know, you write about people who they think they're onto something. Buyers think they're onto something, and they found a source that's going to sell them too good to be true masterworks for very low sums. But, you know, it's a bad sign if somebody's saying, listen, I'll meet you and I'll have the trunk of my Camry open and you can look at the painting.
That's exactly right. You should never buy a masterwork out of the back of a van.
One strategy for making money off forgery I found pretty clever in terms of its restraint. There was a dealer who, I guess, would obtain an original work with all the accompanying documents that said this is an original work, then get to work having one copy made.
My God, that's such a great example, Chris. That's Elie Sakai. And you know, the way he came up with his idea for an art scam is really devious and somewhat ingenious. He had an antique shop, and he was selling a couple of lamps that looked like important, valuable Tiffany lamps.
The stained glass so, lamps, yeah.
Exactly. So he went to an auction and saw what these Tiffany's really looked like, and he didn't see much of a difference except for the stamp label on the bottom. So he created these fake stamped labels. He bought one of them and then made labels and was able to sell these cheap lamps as Tiffany. So then he stepped it up to art. So he would buy some art, he would show, and if you see images of him, he is not anything like you would expect a person to look like when they would go to an art auction. And I don't mean that in any type of profiling way. I mean just the way he would dress. He tried too hard to seem wealthy. Mm-hmm. And he would buy a painting, and as you said, he would have a copy made, and he would sell the copy. Now, what made that plausible is that he was known to be the owner of this painting. So the buyer would say, well, I've checked the provenance, and it was sold to Elie Sakai through whatever auction company. But it was a cheap copy, and it was passable. But when you look at the original and his copies together, you could see the difference. Now, what made him really nefarious, though, are two additional steps. First, he would do this in Japan and in Taiwan because he knew the cultures there made it unlikely that once he was found out that the owners would expose him because the embarrassment was too much.
Hmm.
Secondly, he would use Chinese street artists as well in a studio above his gallery, but he would hold their immigration status over their heads. So it was almost like a form of slavery. Once he had them up there working for him, they were under his control and didn't have much choice.
We're speaking with Anthony M. Amore. He's head of security and chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum of Art in Boston and author of the new book, The Art of the Con, The Most Notorious Fakes, Frauds, and Forgeries in the Art World. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anthony M. Amore about his new book, The Art of the Con, The Most Notorious Fakes, Frauds, and Forgeries in the Art World. We'll go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll speak with John in Oak Cliff.
Yes.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I have a kind of a strange situation. My mother's grandfather was a white Russian. And one of his friends was Anton Refugee, who was a painter. And my grandfather was a doctor. And so to instead of paying him for some services, he painted him a picture. But he didn't sign it, and it's not in his usual style. And most of about everybody who was around when that happened is dead. So I just wondered, how do you go about getting something verified that doesn't have a lot of documentation?
Well, John, that sounds like a tough one. I would, you know, in order to get it accepted as one of his works, that's not always something that's achievable. In that case, I think some of the provenance that I would suggest you try to gather would be records that I think you said your grandfather had held, showing that this is what he received and from whom, and that he was indeed his doctor. And then I think maybe some sort of chemical analysis of the pigments could show that they are developed in from the same region, et cetera, as the artist himself. So those would be a couple of key pieces. I think the people who real lovers of his work, and I'm not familiar with the artist, would be able to discern his style, maybe his brush strokes and that sort of thing. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the same subject matter.
You attribute these assessments in the book, but you quote two people who say, one who says 40%, approximately 40% of what's hanging in museums is forged, 50% of the art on the market could be fake. You didn't name those numbers, but how accurate do you think they might be?
Well, the first one you referred to, the 40% figure, was something put forth by Thomas Hoving, who was at one time the director of the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. Personally, and colleagues that I've spoken to think that's dramatically high, but let's suppose it's high by a factor of four times. That's still 10%. So it is a problem. It ranges from museum to museum. I know that a lot of institutions put a lot of work into studying the provenance. Here in Boston at the MFA, the museum actually hired a curator for provenance to examine their pieces. So it is possible that a lot out there is misattributed or fraud, especially on the market.
Is it the kind of thing that when all the doors are closed and the conference room is filled with just museum people that people talk really openly about?
No, actually, no, it's not something that comes up that often. I think when you think about this stuff being out there, I think one of the topics that comes up is how the market has expanded. I keep referring to the market. And, you know, at one time in the not very distant past, it was galleries that were selling art. Now you have a whole bunch of different institutions, including online. And the bigger the market becomes, the more opportunity for fraud exists.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Daniel in Dallas now. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I was wondering about the people who can actually paint like Rembrandt or Leonardo, and was thinking an honest way of capitalizing on that talent would be to paint in that style modern subjects. And I'm wondering if anybody's doing that.
I couldn't name an artist that's doing it. I do know it is being done. And there's really no style that isn't being executed at this time. It's when you think about, in terms of value, though, when you think about Rembrandt's work, for instance, or Titian, what they created based on what was existing at the time, then you see the worth and the importance, not just in terms of aesthetic, but also history. That drives the value. But yes, there are plenty of artists that paint in a classical style now who do portraits of people and not as many religious scenes as once was, but in landscapes, etc.
It's so strange that something that might have sold on the market for hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars can suddenly be rendered valueless by a new judgment. What happens, though, to those works that suddenly have been declared forgeries that did once grace the walls of galleries and museums and other institutions?
You know, for each piece, something different happens. It depends on who owns it. They may want to destroy it because of the misery it's caused them. But it's unusual for someone to destroy a piece of art. I think it's the sort of thing that winds up on exhibitions of fake art, or is studied by other conservators to see, you know, see what they can learn from the pieces. And sometimes the stuff is sold as, you know, this is a copy of whomever. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes these forgers, their own works become, you know, they were failures as artists before they did forgeries. And after they become a famous forger, they find a market for their work. So every one of these stories has a different route that it takes.
You mentioned exhibitions of fake art, which is something that the producer of the show, Stephen Becker, and I were discussing a while ago. This is a thing? Do they have traveling exhibitions of forged art just to show people the difference?
Oh, yes. Yep. And I'm good friends with a woman who has an exhibition. The name of the exhibition's escaped me, but her name is Colette Lal, and she's an expert in these forgeries. And she travels around with fake Modiglianis and Rembrandts and Van Goghs and you name it. And it's really something to see because they are beautiful works in their own right.
That's strange, isn't it? That you know you're not supposed to think so, but they can be, you know, technically well executed, I guess.
Sure. You know, you could make a painting that's based on, and many reputable artists do, and are inspired by famous artists. So you could do something in the style of Van Gogh that would be absolutely beautiful. and can be appreciated and enjoyed. But when you try to pass it off as Van Gogh's own work, that's where you you cross the line.
I recognize that you have responsibility to an important museum and it is filled with priceless objects. I wonder, though, if you ever have that, like, that emperor's new clothes question about, you know, the dollar value that we assign to works of art and whether it's appropriate.
Well, you know, that's something I think about very often because the museum I work in is incredibly unique. When Isabella Stewart Gardner died, the will she left behind said nothing can ever be removed or changed or moved to another gallery or sold off. So her work is really the true definition of pricelessness. So, for instance, we have Titian's Rape of Europa, which is considered, if not the, amongst the most important works in the Western world. And people are always asking me, whenever I tell them that, they say, well, what's it worth? And who knows how much it's worth? Can you even put a dollar value on it? It almost seems unseemly because it's historic importance. But these are the true definition of pricelessness. So I'm kind of in a rarefied air there when you talk about value of art and how we approach it.
Do you buy art yourself just for your home?
You know, funny enough, the pieces of art that I have in my home are copies, not by forgers, of the pieces of work that I'm searching for that were stolen from the Gardner. So I have a framed version of the concert by Vermeer, and I have Lady and Gentleman in Black by Rembrandt. And in my office, I have The Storm in the Sea of Galilee. So I kind of obsess on those 13 pieces.
I would think having those, like, you know, to look at every day when you go home and they're in your office, they would almost taunt you.
They do, and you're right, and they absolutely do. But, you know, at the Gardner, we, I don't know if you've been there, but we have empty frames up as well.
Yeah.
And those are reminders every day. But I try to look at these things as placeholders. They're reminders that this is what the goal is, that these have to come back, and that I'm not going to stop until we do get them back.
I think the empty frames are very poignant.
They are. You know, sometimes I've talked to people who wonder if the museum is trying to capitalize on its loss, and it's an obscene suggestion. You know, the poignancy is the key, but they also are a reminder to the public that things belong here. We can't replace them. We will put our paintings back in these frames.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Nada on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Nada.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Good. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for bringing this very important topic. I am an art historian with a specialty in modern contemporary Middle Eastern art, and I work specifically with stolen Iraqi work from the museum in Baghdad. Hmm. And probably, you know, your guest knows that there's a growing market also for non-Western modern contemporary art. After the Iraq invasion for Iraqi art, with the situation in Syria for Syrian art. And we've often, you know, encountered issues and challenges with auction houses selling works, trying to convince them that these are forged works, because there's a large forgery market at the moment. My question is, what happens when some of these works and some of are, you know, making their way to museums in America and in Europe? What kind of, you know, investigation do museums have? What kind of mechanisms do they have to know if the work is stolen or forged?
It's a fascinating question that sort of turns everything we've been talking about upside down. Real works that are being passed off as forgeries so that they can be traded theoretically, ethically.
Isn't that something? I mean, Nada raises a great point. She's right about the market and the demand for Middle Eastern art of all sorts. Every institution does their own sort of work. I can tell you from my experience that the vast majority of museums are very ethical. The last thing in the world they want to do is some sort of violation of the the standard of ethics in the art world. And you know, even for a selfish purpose, nobody wants to be on the front page of the paper as having a looted piece of art. It's just ugly publicity-wise and bad even for the trustees and donations and such. The art that was stolen from the Iraqi museum, is the reason that there's an art crime team in the FBI today. It was formed after that, after the invasion and after losses there. So each institution has to take it upon itself to make sure that they're buying in good conscience, and they buying from reputable dealers. Usually museums will work with the same reputable people over and over. And I do have faith that they're curatorial departments and their conservation departments, their acquisition teams, work really hard to ensure that the provenance is solid. But, you know, so much was looted in Iraq that it's possible that things do slip through. And Chris, you make such a great point that you're talking about real things that are being passed off as copies and in order to legitimize them. It's an amazing scenario.
People who go into journalism have to take, like, media ethics classes and law classes, and people can argue all day whether or not they forget everything the moment they walk outside the door, but they're there. Do people who, you know, study art history, are they required to take ethics courses?
That would vary from fine arts program to fine arts program, whether ethics in the art world is a required course. I would imagine that most reputable programs do have that, because you cannot avoid those questions if you're going to study fine art. I mean, that's right there. It would be like studying criminal justice and never looking at homicide. So I'm sure that it's something that's required in the most reputable programs, but whether one course is enough to take those dollar signs away from people who can't help but want to hear a really good story. You know, almost like, please tell me a good story so I can buy this from you. That's where the gray area exists.
People in my price range who can buy art at all, you know, buy it for very modest sums, and they buy it because they love it and they intend to hang it on the wall and enjoy it. I wonder what you think about the wisdom or folly of purchasing art with the intention of making money from it at some point as an investment.
Well, I think if you study the market well enough, it can be profitable. But the one thing, one of the things I took away from this book was the number of people who make these massive purchases, tens of millions of dollars of on art, and never take that extra step to go to someone like Dr. Nicholas Eastar, who I mentioned earlier, and say, "Can you examine this for me and give me your scientific and art history opinion on this?" An independent third party. And regardless of the thousands that might cost, when you think about the cost benefit, it boggles the mind that more people don't utilize that sort of service.
It's like taking a used car to a mechanic before you sign the paperwork.
Exactly right. Or at least do the Carfax report.
The provenance is the Carfax report. Is that right?
That's true. Right. Yep.
Anthony M. Amore is head of security and chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum of Art in Boston. His newest book is called The Art of the Con, The Most Notorious Fakes, Frauds, and Forgeries in the Art World. Anthony, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.